Our 10:15 have arrived and call the House Tax Committee to order. We have a very, very full agenda. We have a very full agenda for the day. We're going to kind of not necessarily go by what it is, because yesterday I promised that the first bill would be Representative Weiner, and Dan Madden has some other places to go to. So, Representative Weiner, if you want to join. Okay, where's. And while he's getting up there, Representative Joy moves the minutes of March 4th, 2025. Any additions or corrections? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Joy. Item next, we will go right to, let's go right to Representative Weiner here. We've got, it's House File 812. If you could provide your, or tell us about your bill, and then we'll bring Nan Madden up. Is there anyone else on this bill that wishes to testify for the bill or with concern? Okay, that's pretty clear cut then. Representative Weiner, to the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee members. And I apologize. Yesterday we had a full committee room. All the seats were filled for my bill, and unfortunately the weather didn't work out, and it got pushed back. So next time. Well, thank you. This is a common sense bill. This is tax relief for the hardest working people in the state of Minnesota. Our state did not have income taxes until 1933. And since that time, we've become the highest marginal state, individual income tax, I'm sorry, and it's got the highest rates at the bottom income bracket. We are taxing people out of our state. We're uncompetitive with our neighbors. Iowa, Wisconsin, South Dakota, North Dakota all have lower tax brackets than we do. Iowa has a 3.9 single rate. Wisconsin has a 3.5 lowest bracket. South Dakota has no income tax, and North Dakota has a graduated income tax ranging from 1.95 to 2.5. Taxpayers across the state of Minnesota have been saying the same thing. We need relief. We had an $18 billion surplus. Campaign promises across the state at all levels where we were going to make Minnesota affordable. Promises of $2,000 tax returns to people never came to fruition. Property tax relief never happened, and unfortunately we ended up with more unfunded mandates. We're creating a situation in our state where the hardest working people are paying the most and they're suffering the most. And this would cut that lowest tax bracket in order to make life livable in Minnesota. So imagine, if you will, you're making under $38,000 a year. If this bill were passed, it would be like getting 50 cents to a dollar per hour onto your check. That could be huge. That's transformative. Historic was the terminology we heard the last 2 years. Passing a bill like this would be historic for the taxpayers of the state of Minnesota. Now, I understand that not every bill is perfect coming out of the gates, and I would love to work with other individuals to make this a priority bill moving forward. There has been some suggestions, and I'm open to different ideas. Sorry, I'm on the wrong page here. And I'm open to ideas to make this a better bill. One of the ideas was to move the tax brackets, and I'm sure Nan will be talking about that a little bit. That was an amendment I looked at. Wasn't necessarily put in this bill, but I'm willing to discuss that further with other individuals. Now, I know in the state of Minnesota, we're also looking at a tax deficit.
Sorry.
Huge. If this bill were to be passed, we would have a deficit in our state, or it would leave us with a budget or a hole in our budget, which kind of turns into a circular argument. We can't cut the tax bracket because we need the revenue to pay for the programs to help the people in the lowest tax bracket. This bill helps those people out. It's a common sense bill. Let's move it forward. And in closing, I would just like to say, I'm sure we all on the tax committee have our favorite economists that we like to, read at all hours in the morning, whether it's Hayek's, probably Pike, Marx, Kenzie. My favorite is Milton Friedman. And the quote I love from him is, I'm in favor of cutting taxes under any circumstance, for any excuse, for any reason, whenever it's possible. This bill is a good start in that direction. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you, Representative Wiener. Let's go to witnesses. We have Nan Madden. If you would please introduce yourself and who you represent for the record and then provide your testimony. Then we'll go to member questions. This is a bill that we would lay over, so we're not going to actually vote on it today, but I just want to. Okay, please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Nan Madden. I'm the Minnesota Budget Project Director at the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits. I am testifying today with concerns about House File 812. I do appreciate and share Representative Wiener's goal of using our tax policy to improve the lives of everyday Minnesotans, but this bill as it's drafted is not a good tool for that goal. And it has the same problem as other proposals we've seen that would change the rate in the first bracket. Those proposals are not well targeted to folks struggling to get ahead, and everyday folks would be harmed by the cuts in public services that would likely happen to pay for these tax cuts. The revenue analysis from the Department of Revenue estimates that 20% of Minnesota income tax filers would not receive any benefit from this proposal. These are folks that are paying taxes to fund state and local services in Minnesota. They just happen to pay their taxes more through the sales tax and the property tax. And at the same time that one of five Minnesotans are left out, higher income Minnesotans would receive annual tax cuts of over $2,500 for married filing joint returns and over $1,700 if filing single. It's not necessary to give tax cuts to high income households if the goal is helping everyday Minnesotans. So why is this the case that many lower income folks are left out or get a smaller cut and those with higher incomes get larger tax cuts? In a bill that's focused on the first bracket. It goes back to the fact that Minnesotans do not pay income tax on all of our income, but on a smaller measure that's called taxable income. And only those households that have taxable incomes that reach the top of the first tax bracket would get the maximum tax cut. So the maximum tax cuts goes to folks whose taxable incomes reaches into the second, third, and top brackets. So I'll give you an example of a family that does not get the maximum tax cut from this proposal. We'll take a married couple of two children, an adjusted gross income of $60,000, and a fairly simple tax return. So they claim the standard deduction, as well as a dependent exemption for each of their two children. And I want to flag that the dependent exemption is a very positive feature of Minnesota's income tax code, that we take family size into account in determining taxable income. So that family with AGI of $60,000, their taxable income is under $20,000. So not high enough to hit the top of the first bracket. They would get a smaller tax cut from this bill than a family with higher incomes. And if this family had more children, because of those additional dependent exemptions, they would get an even smaller tax cut, if any, and they'd be even further away from the amount of income they would need, taxable income they would need to get the maximum tax cut under this bill. At a cost of roughly $4 billion a year, this expensive tax cut would come at the cost of deep cuts to services that Minnesotans count on. This is a time when federal policymakers are considering drastic cuts in funding for states, especially in health care, which is a very important area of the budget for our Minnesota families. Cutting taxes at this time would make it harder to protect the services that Minnesotans count on, not only health care, but also supports for seniors and people with disabilities, schools, transportation, and other crucial services. And I think it's the folks who are struggling the most to get by who would feel the greatest harm from those cuts to services, while those who are better off would see larger tax cuts. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any questions for the testifier, Ms. Madden? Thank you so much. Now, questions for members for the author. Okay, a department, would the department like to weigh in? Okay. Any questions? With that, I'll renew my motion.
Just if I could wrap up on the bill.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Or some, anybody else?
Was anybody, I missed somebody?
We were just trying to get organized.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate this bill, Representative Wiener. I think your intentions are pure here in trying to help lower income individuals in the state of Minnesota. I just don't think this bill does that. It is a very expensive bill. I think the price tag is, depending on the biennium, about $8 billion, which is quite a large price tag. And I want to direct members of the committee to the memo that was written by Mr. Williams that is included in the packets. Table 1 models the distribution of tax reductions by income tax year 2025. And you look at that, and I think despite the intentions of the bill, the actuality of the bill is that most of the benefits of this bill would go to the highest income Minnesotans. In fact, those who have an income of greater than $100,000 will account for 53.7%, almost 54% of the decrease in revenue from the state. And the lower incomes, those that earn less than $30,000, only get 2% of the decrease that this tax cut creates. And then if you look at that far left column, the number of returns, you see that the people who make more than $100,000 are the minority of people in this state. It's only 40% of the returns we get. So they're getting 54% of the benefit for only 40% of the people. And the people who need it the most are getting the least out of this deduction. So I appreciate the intents behind this bill, but I just don't think this is the way that we help people who are most in need in the state. Thanks, Mr.
Thank you, Representative Smith. Representative Gomez, want to wrap it up?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Andy sort of said it. This costs $17 billion, right, in your manner of accounting. $17 billion hole in the side of our budget, and what do you think is going to happen? Are we going to be able to cut $17 billion in spending? Or, you know, because that is how a budget works. You either have to make up with it for other revenues, and as we know in this committee, the income tax is why we have the most progressive tax code in the country, the most progressive state tax code out of the 50 states in D.C., is because we have an income tax. And as we've said, are you going to cut money for our schools? Are you going to cut human services dollars for seniors, for people with disabilities? Are you going to cut nursing homes? Are you going to cut roads and bridges? Are you going to cut investment in law enforcement, public safety? Are we going to cut funding for our counties and for our cities? If we were talking about $17 billion, we'd have to do all of those things. All of those things. And, you know, the benefits of this tax cut disproportionately go to the top income earners in the state. And as Ms. Madden pointed out, it's not that lower income people don't pay taxes. They pay them in the more regressive major tax types that we have. They pay through the sales tax and through the property tax. And as we've discussed extensively in this committee, when you decrease the share of public services that the state pays for, you put those costs onto our local partners. And what are the tax tools that our local partners have at their disposal? The most regressive forms of tax, particularly the property tax, which we actually all hear about when we go in our communities. So, you know, this is just I understand the intent. This is using a chainsaw to do something that a scalpel should be doing. If you really want to help low-income people, which I genuinely believe you do, Representative Wiener, because we've talked about you know, your constituents and the kind of average income level of your constituents. And I think that, you know, I probably have way more rich people in my district, but some of the characteristics of our districts align. The low-income people in my community have the same needs as the low-income people in your community. But this 54% of the tax cut, of the $17 billion that would go to, you know, the top income earners in Minnesota, you know, who it just really doesn't kind of even out and doesn't achieve the intent. But thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Wiener, like to wrap it up?
Absolutely. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks, committee. And as I said, I'd be more than willing to work with anybody to make this bill better. And as I stated before, by adjusting the tax brackets, we could target the lowest individuals here. Instead of helping make this bill better automatically, it's all or nothing. We are in these committees supposed to and expected to work together to a certain extent. And instead of doing that, it's automatically torpedoing a bill that we could improve on, which is really disappointing. Because instead of helping those lowest the people in the lowest tax bracket, you're going to say it's all or nothing. I want to help those people out. You know the intent. And instead of working together, that's not going to happen. In the state of Minnesota here, our state budget has more than doubled in the last 10 years. We've gone from $35 billion to over $70 billion. And no one is saying, what does this do to the taxpayers out there? We're talking about how it affects our budget, our state budget. But what about the workers themselves? The people who are basically being crushed in this state by an ever-expanding government and tax burden that's literally driving them out. As I stated, I would love to work with anybody on this bill to make it better, and instead of working with them, we decided that it's an all-or-nothing bill, and that's disappointing. I intend to work for the people in this state. The lowest tax bracket primarily. We can start there. We could have offered an amendment to make this better, and I would have loved to work with that. So moving forward, once again, I'm going to quote Milton Friedman, because I'm sure everybody else loves to hear this. I'm in favor of cutting taxes under any circumstances, for any excuse, for any reason, whenever it is possible. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Weiner moves that House File 812 be later for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you, Representative Weiner. Thank you, Ms. Madden. Item next. Who brought the rolls, by the way? Oh, you did? Okay, you're next then. Okay. Has nothing to do with my decision. You are at the top of the list here. So I will move House File 403. It says 409, but let's correct that. It's 403. Okay, I believe let's get this bill in the shape the author like. I believe Chair Gomez is going to move the H0403DE1 amendment. Is that correct?
Oh, Chair's amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Tell us about your amendment.
Sure, I will. Yes, thank you. The underlying bill, House File 403, I'll let Representative Myers explain his bill. But as we've discussed in this committee, it's not just those who live in homesteads or those who own their own homes who pay property taxes. There's an assumption built into the property tax refund for renters that about 17% of those who pay rent, of rent goes toward paying the property taxes for the landlord. The 403DE1 just allows the benefit that is in the underlying bill to be extended to renters. Mr. Chair, and I'll just speak, I can just go ahead. I'm gonna withdraw it. We don't have to take a vote on it. I just really feel strongly that we have to, obviously, we have a lot of senior citizens in all of our communities who are struggling to make ends meet, and a lot of those struggling seniors live in rental housing, and a lot of our lowest income seniors overall end up living in rental housing. And so, I just think that when we are extending benefits to seniors associated with property taxes, that we have to keep this in mind, and that we design programs that are supposed to help low-income seniors with their housing costs that completely cuts out this entire sector of seniors in our communities. And so, we don't have to take a vote on it. I'll withdraw it, but I guess I just would ask, this bill is being laid over, and that as we are looking at, costs for seniors, especially associated with housing, that we took, not to keep bringing up the legends of Blaine, Representative Norris, but we have to think about all of those seniors who live in low-income rental housing that's specifically focused on seniors, and ensure that we're keeping in mind their costs also. So thank you, Mr. Chair. I withdraw the amendment.
Chair Gomez withdraws the DE1 amendment. I think the Legends of Blanche had the most famous housing complex in the world.
Well, we're going to make it so, Mr. Chair. Should. That's our intent here at Tax Committee. Pass a budget, make Legends of Blaine more legendary than it already is.
I'm in.
All right, let's I'm do in. It.
Okay, so amendment withdrawn by Chair Gomez. We now have House File 403 before us. Representative Myers, if you could please explain your bill. First of all, is there anyone wish to testify for the bill or with concerns? The department wants to weigh in? No? We gotta get the department in one of these here, just for fun. Okay. Tomorrow we'll get you in. Okay, Representative Myers, to your bill.
Thank you, Chair Davids, and thank you, Chair Gomez and members, for having me here today. House File 403 is a discussion here to talk about that much-needed property tax relief that we hear every day from our seniors. We want to keep them in their homes. We want to keep them in our communities. Many retirees are on fixed incomes. They're seeing rising taxes, rising property taxes that are putting a financial strain on them. And some of these seniors we see have to sell their homes or cut back on essential expenses that they need. So under this bill, the homeowner would make an initial application to the county to receive the credit. After that, anytime their tax increase would be more than 8% from one year to the next, the credit would be automatically kicked in and reduce their taxes to no more than 8% of the prior year. I think this is a reasonable opportunity. I know we have a budget forecast coming out. I was really trying to keep something that I thought was actionable. For me, it's not trying to pass a really big bill, but maybe we heard previously. Something that is.
Well, Representative Myers, I was always told go big or go home, and to defend Representative Wiener, he went big and. He's still here. So,
Chair Davids, I appreciate that. As the youngest of five, my mom never let me do that, so I always kind of had to. I always had to stay in line. So,
Representative Myers,
thank you, Chair. I appreciate this opportunity. We want to continue to have these conversations, and I think there's a fiscal note in here. It's something I think, and Chair Gomez said before, it's something that we hear back in our districts, and it's something that we're trying to address, and this is just one way to do that, so I'd ask members to support it.
Thank you, Representative Myers. Any questions for the author? Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm reading this, and I know the author talked about, helping the seniors who are on fixed income, but want to just check, there's no income limit to this program, right?
Representative Myers.
Thank you, Representative. No, there is not, and I did that as, I guess, my bigger go home piece. I wanted to start with the largest group of people so we could see what the fiscal impact is, because I think this is something that is scalable.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Chair. I just offer, we already have a similar program like this. I know that when I door knock and I talk to seniors in my community, I tell them that there is already a senior deferral program and it's actually underutilized. And so, if this bill is really big and something that, we can't budget for, maybe we can just make sure the folks know that there is a program already that they could possibly qualify for. So, thanks.
Representative Myers. Any question? Other questions? I will move House File 403 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you, and thank you for what you brought. Appreciate it. And also, I want to thank Jennifer here for she brought king cake. I think is there a little left here?
Yes, there's more here, so help yourselves.
Say it's there's none
Louisiana.
Left. Say there's none left, and I'll take it. So, no, that king, get some king cake. It's actually from Louisiana. Came up from Louisiana, so.
Yes, my husband lives there.
So, Louisiana. Okay, so item next, we'll go to the Davids bill, House File 951.
I think that Smith would be bringing the next one because I think he found the prize.
Correct, I got the baby.
Oh, you got the baby.
He got the baby.
Nice.
All right.
I'll see you all in 2026.
Okay, I'm going to take the bill from here. I don't want to hit anybody walk over there with my crutches here. So I'll move House File 951. And I would like, and you got some information in here from various groups, and if Ms. Hagler could explain it, so it's explained properly.
Mr. Chair and members, House File 952 expands the current exemption for telecommunication and pay TV service machinery and equipment so that the equipment can be exempt from sales tax even if it is not primarily used for providing the telecom and pay TV services. If it at least provides some of those services, then the equipment and machinery would be exempt.
Okay, thank you. I have a witness that's listed here, Sarah Pisick, CTIA Wireless Association. We also have, it's very important to another group, Mr. Christensen, Brent Christensen. Why don't you come up here too for if there's any questions on what we're doing here. Ms. Pisick, please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Sarah Pisick, and I represent CTIA, which is an association representing wireless providers. Thank you so much for having the bill here today and for authoring it, Chair Davids. House File 951 simply deletes the word primarily in the current sales tax exemption for machinery and equipment primarily used to provide telecommunications or pay television services. Deleting the word primarily will modernize the statute to reflect the changing nature of communication services. I did a little research last night during the snowstorm to find out when the current law was adopted. And I found that the original statute was actually adopted in 2001. So as you can imagine, and as you all know, the communications industry has changed significantly since 2001. Wireless, wireline, and cable networks are used to deliver traditional pay television services, streaming audio and video services, internet access service, social media applications that allow voice and video communications, and the traditional wireless and wireline communication services. It's the same equipment that is used to provide all of these services, and the use of the word primarily is just out of date with today's technology. A provider that sells telecommunications services, internet access, and video services as part of a bundled offering might be using the network for telecommunications or pay television services for some customers, and then others are only using that network for internet service. So amending the sales tax and use exemption by removing the word primarily will clarify that the network equipment used to provide telecommunications or pay television is exempt even if other services are used over those networks. It'll also encourage continued investment in broadband communication networks, which the state and the providers have been making to expand broadband access in rural and underserved areas. And the bill provides uncertainty, or will provide clarity and certainty for telecommunications providers and the Department of Revenue when trying to decide how to interpret the primarily language. So in the simplest of terms, it's really impossible, or nearly impossible, to determine exactly what service a customer is primarily receiving from the equipment. And it might be different for each customer, but it's the same equipment. So taking out the word primarily, just to emphasize again, will help clarify that uncertainty. So we really thank you for considering this bill today. In your letter, or in your package, is a letter from CTIA, as well as from Minnesota Cable Association, who also support the bill. And then Brent Christensen is here as well. Thank you.
Mr. Christensen, please introduce yourself and provide testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Good morning. My name is Brent Christensen. I'm the president and CEO of the Minnesota Telecom Alliance. We're a trade association that represents rural broadband providers throughout the state of Minnesota. I appreciate this bill. We also have a similar bill that Chair Davids is the chief author on. And long story short, this fixes a problem that none of us knew was going to happen. In 2013, the legislature removed the sales tax exemption on capital expenditure equipment for telecommunications. In 2017, that exemption was restored and expanded to include fiber and conduit. It was the intent of the legislature in 2017 to have a sales tax exemption for fiber and conduit. We did not know, and by that I mean Commissioner Marquardt was the chair of this committee. Nobody on the committee knew that this was going to be a problem. We didn't, as the industry, didn't know this was going to be a problem, that there was a separate statute that said it had to be primarily used for telephone or television. That was not the intent of the legislature in 2017, and this fixes that. So here's what this has been doing. Over the past couple of years, my members have had sales tax audits, and the auditors have looked at this in different ways. We have one company where the auditor said, no, you have to pay a sales tax on it because you're using it for internet. We have another company that said, okay, you can take the sales tax exemption on the fiber and conduit, but you have to prove that 51% of that was used for television or telephone and on the revenue part of it. And then a third company that said, no, you're using it for telephone or television, so it's not a problem. So we are also working with the Department of Revenue to try and get a more unified approach to this. But in the meantime, this bill will fix a problem that none of us saw coming. So I would appreciate your support. Let's get this fixed, and let's advance broadband in Minnesota. And with that, I'm happy to stand for questions.
Thank you. Before we go to questions for the two testifiers, would the department like to weigh in on this one? No? Okay. Okay, questions for the two testifiers. Very simple what we're doing. We're just removing one word so it clears up the sales tax issues. Okay, I'll renew. Oh, I'm sorry. Just
quickly.
Yeah, no, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Chair. So, you know, there's nothing, I guess, terribly wrong with this on the face of it. It is a $250 million over our budget window, $250 million existing expenditure to exempt this infrastructure from taxes. And those decisions get made along the way. But if you've been around in this committee for a few years, what you will notice is that any attempt to clarify the language, to streamline the process, to ease the administrative burden, yeah, always goes in favor of the corporations and not the taxpayers of Minnesota. It always goes in the direction of narrowing the tax base and costing the public something. And so, you know, that's all I'll say is that this is a proposal for another $13 million a year to the telecom industry. I'm sure it will make them happy, but it you know, the question is like, what is that by the people? What is the benefit, you know, to taxpayers? And, you know, so it's interesting to see these things. These tax expenditures in particular that go to specific corporate sectors, that it seems there's never-ending pressure bit by bit to make them more expensive, more expansive, and to further diminish the tax base in Minnesota. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Chair Gomez, I apologize to you. There's another member wanted to speak, so we'll let him speak, and then we can come back to you if you have any other comments.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Swinzinski.
Can I address that question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I didn't mean to jump behind you. I raised my hand earlier, I thought. So.
Got him right here.
Yeah, so, just a quick question, kind of just from a practical note, you know, just kind of just glancing at the bill, it talks about more of a telecommunications and television portion of that from an entertainment standpoint. Does this at all extend to kind of from a digital side, or does it have to be like from a YouTube channel standpoint or any of those types of things, or is this strictly from a business, would that affect it because of from a broadcast portion? Mr. Chair.
Ms. Pisick? Or Mr. Christensen?
Mr. Chair, Representative Swiatkowski, no, this is capital expenditures. This is actually putting fiber in the ground. This is not the content that is
not
that goes over
top. Okay, that's what I got. Okay, thank you. And just from an early contact, you know, I know a lot of, from a sales tax standpoint, I know I've heard from a lot of businesses that oftentimes, you know, as a sales tax collector, they're tasked with the job of collecting the sales taxes, organizing them, figuring out how much they owe, collecting them from the customers, and there's no reimbursement for that, you know, for the state. So, you know, corporations in general are viewed, you know, primarily as tax collectors for the state. If there is costs that are involved with whether it's income tax from a corporate level or sales tax, those are all from the tax incident studies, those are all passed on to the consumer. So while we may say in it, that it's going to be a tax that's, you know, paid by these guys and we're trying to ease in their burden, it's us that pay it. It's the mom and pop shops, it's whoever, it's the folks that are paying for their cable bill, whatever. Those costs are simply a pass-through for these businesses. And so, you know, the idea that we're going to get them or they're going to pay more, it's the studies have proven that that's just, it doesn't work. It just gets passed on. So that's all.
Any comments from the testifiers? And then we'll go back to Chair Gomez if she'd like.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I just want to clarify that the equipment that's being installed today, this helps clarify what has been confusing between the Department of Revenue and companies, because the equipment's being installed and it's the same equipment that in some interpretations is exempt from the sales tax and then other times it's, you know, potentially not, because it's a determination of what is primarily being used across that equipment, and it's, you know, what is the customer primarily getting, what is the equipment providing, but it's the same equipment, if that makes sense to you, because the telecommunications has evolved and people are getting more services through the same equipment. So this really helps clarify for both the telecommunications companies as well as the department in how to apply the sales tax exemption. And I think Mr. Chair Gomez,
I want to thank you for your question. I should have incorporated that into my comments. My members are mainly Main Street businesses in Minnesota. About half of our members are cooperatives. The other half are family-owned, publicly traded, privately held company. I come from a family-owned company that's fifth generation. Two points to respond to your questions. First one is, it's our position that had the bill passed in 2017 the way that it was intended to, those taxes wouldn't have been collected. So I don't believe that we're taking money out of the tax coffers. We're just not over collecting what we shouldn't have been collecting. And two, for our members and that are affected by this the most, we're partners with the state of Minnesota to provide border-to-border broadband. And that money that we don't pay on sales tax is a dollar-for-dollar investment in broadband and increasing services to Minnesotans that don't have access to quality broadband now. So that's the intent of this. And to Ms. Pasik's comments, this is not being applied fairly and evenly across the board right now, and this bill would fix that and make it more fair.
Any other questions for any members? We'll go back to Chair Gomez.
Oops.
Chair Gomez? Okay. Okay. Thank you. Representative Lee.
Thank you. And I actually think this is really well timed, because I was going to ask about that connectivity piece, because I used to do telecom policy also, and one of the struggles is always, you know, are the companies investing in the infrastructure to put in the wires. And so for me, my guess is probably somebody thought this was a good idea at one point because they wanted to connect everybody across Minnesota. And so I know we probably don't have the answer to this today, but my question would just be, you know, is this working? And, you know, are people actually connected? Because I know we had a previous member in our committee who was all the way up in Virginia, and sometimes it'd be really hard to do committee work. And so that would just be my question, because I think that was something that Chair Gomez was getting to earlier, just when we use public dollars to incentivize putting in infrastructure to connect people, because we think it's a public good. We just want to make sure it works. So thanks.
Thank you. Any further comments on the bill? Otherwise, I will renew my motion that House File 951 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you, members, and I apologize for not being in order.
Thank you.
We must have order. Okay, item next. Now, here's what we're looking like for the rest of the meeting here today. We have, where is it here? Here we go. We want to get Representative Coulter's bill up, House File 1088, but he is asked to go last, so later. He has some other things going on. And then we'd like to get to the Baker bill. He can't be here till about 11:15. So from now until then, and if we can get this one later for possible inclusion, that'd be great. So we'll go to House File 1277. We talked about this one quite a bit, but I think there were possibly some more questions. I have no testifiers at this point. We did the public testimony last week.
Yep.
Last week. So I will move House File 1277 with the understanding that if there's a longer debate on it, which is fine, as soon as we get Chairman Baker in, we'll go to him, and Representative Coulter asked to go last, but we want to get him in or his bill heard today too. So House File 1277, we heard this quite a while last week, but there may be some more member questions, and I think Chair Gomez probably has a wrap-up here on this one. So let's go to member questions. If there are none, we'll go to Chair Gomez. Member question. This is the data center bill. Representative Smith.
So, Chair, I think I have 20 minutes, you said, right, till 11:15?
You have till 11:15.
Okay, great. I'll leave the time for Chair Gomez. So I am not in favor of this sales tax exemptions for huge data centers for four reasons. First, I think it's important to put on the record how incredible the usage of energy these facilities put out. When we heard testimony on this last week, we heard about Virginia and how they're leading the way in the country, Data Center Alley, and a report was referenced both by testifiers and myself that reported on that data. And I think it's important to talk about some of the findings of this report. So I want to read one quick section about the energy usage that these data centers have. Modern data centers consume substantially more energy than other types of commercial or industrial operations. For example, one of the smaller data centers recently constructed in Virginia can draw up to 18 megawatts of power. This is roughly equivalent to a mid-sized automobile assembly plant, 60 large commercial office buildings, or 4,500 residential homes. The largest new data centers can draw from 100 to over 200 megawatts each, which is more than most industrial consumers. Some planned data centers, data center campuses are expected to consume well over 1,000 megawatts once fully built out, which is more than 950 megawatts generation capacity of the state's largest nuclear reactor. 1,000 megawatts is roughly equivalent to 250,000 homes. That's more homes than are in the city of Minneapolis, by about 50,000. That is the energy usage that these data centers can consume. And under this bill, would be completely exempt from any sales tax on those in perpetuity. The report also goes on to say the people who are going to bear the brunt of that high usage of energy being completely tax exempt are other customers of electricity, which is all of us, which is small businesses, which are residential homes. The report found that residents' monthly costs just because of data centers would rise 33%, while Amazon Web Services and Meta, who are using most of that increase in energy usage, are not paying any sales tax on any of that. I think it's extremely irresponsible for the future of our state in an energy perspective and from a budget perspective. Number one. Number two, this is an unnecessary increase in this tax credit. We already have a data center equipment exemption, and it's being used quite substantially. It's about $110 million a year, not per biennium. And we already have a lot of data centers in Minnesota providing jobs, both in the data center industry and construction industry. You can get a list of those who are using it, big and smaller companies that are building data centers. Meta is building a huge facility right now in Rosemont. It's working. And expanding that for these massive data centers that will use this extension and expanding the expansion to actually electric use is just not necessary to provide the jobs, which is the number one argument coming here. By the way, in that in the report, in our general sales and use tax exemptions report, there's a great note about a revenue neutral rate because these are sales tax exemptions. So they tell you if we repealed that, what we could do to the general sales and use tax. And if we got rid of the current one, we could lower our sales and use tax by almost a tenth of a percentage point. It's quite a lot that I think many Minnesotans, including low-income Minnesotans, would benefit from. My third one is I want to talk about the jobs that have been discussed here, because it is true that building these data centers do create jobs in our trades, and I do appreciate that, and I'm thankful for any jobs that are created in our state. But if we pass this massive increase in our current tax policy to include that, we do lose revenue, and that means more consistent streams of construction jobs, particularly in our transportation sector and particularly in bonding bills coming out of this legislature, will decrease because we have less funds to put towards those. In fact, the same week that we heard this exemption, we heard a bill that was slashing almost every single transportation fund we have in the state. When, just like we said earlier, when we cut certain parts of the budget, other parts also suffer. And my final point on all of this is to really ask the question, who is going to benefit the most from this tax cut? And it's not the trades who are getting jobs, because again, the jobs in other sectors will decrease if we pass this. It's massive companies, some of the richest companies in the history of the world, Amazon, Meta, Google, SpaceX. They will be getting a massive tax write-off, and that is not what we should be doing with our budget. So I'm a no on this, Chair.
Well, thank you. I'll work on you. We'll sit down and visit my neighbor to the north. But I do remind, and I understand what you're saying. I get it. But this is a fun bill to work on. It's very bipartisan. There's a Senate DFLer has it here, and you'll know some very good DFL names on this bill. But you're that's why we're having this discussion. We want to appreciate your comments. Rep. Smith Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So Rep. Smith said most everything already, but I did want to point folks to what Rep. Smith talked about would look like in Minnesota. I think just last month, the Star Tribune started doing a series on covering the data center projects in Minnesota. And so I just want to read the first sentence from an article on February 17th. Amazon wants to install so many backup diesel generators at its potential data center in Becker, Minnesota, that the maximum power output would rival Xcel Energy's nuclear power plant in Monticello. And so these energy concerns are real. They're here. And I just think as our trade war started yesterday with Canada, we have to keep in mind that there are Minnesotans who rely on power from Canada. And so I just want folks to be mindful of that as we continue to talk about this bill. Something that I think we haven't talked about a lot, but Mr. Martin drew attention to last week was this bill is seeking to supercharge our current exemption. There is a definition of large data center that may seem large now, but the impact of this is probably that in the future, every data center will be given this special privilege to get the tax credit up front, as we talked about. And so I just want to point folks to that. It's concerning, and it's something we should talk about. I mean, we already have an existing form of this exemption, and like adding this definition of large data center is actually really concerning and something we should think about as the industry continues to grow at, you know, exponential rates. It's probably a definition that needs to have some flexibility in changing if this is something that we're going to adopt. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Lee. Representative Herr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question, and I know, because I'm old, I can't remember why I wrote myself this note the last time we heard this, but I remembered reading in the report, I think, that the Virginia report that Representative Smith mentioned, that they said one of the benefits of data center is from business, personal property, and real property taxes. And I was looking at, it said Minnesota exempts personal property, including machinery inventory, from property tax. So I guess I was just curious, some of the benefits that were stated in this Virginia report, would Minnesota be reaping that benefit from it as well?
Could you help us, Ms. Hagler, on that one, the her question? Or, Ms. Swanson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Herr, these data center properties would be subject to property taxes. I'd like to double check the personal property portion of it. The real property would definitely be subject to property taxes. There are some specific exemptions to personal property in Minnesota, and I'd just like to double check that before giving you the answer on that one.
Representative Herr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think that, you know, and it is really a legitimate question for me, because I do believe that if a report is saying that there are benefits to this, then we're not going to be reaping those benefits. It would be really good for us to know, you know, what we're not gaining from doing what other states might be doing around data centers. So I'd appreciate that.
Thank you, Representative Herr. Okay, we will go to Chair Gomez. Or did I miss somebody? Chair Gomez.
Sorry,
Representative Robbins, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this might be a question for Ms. Hagler, but the current data center sales tax exemption, can you just, my understanding is that has a sunset, but this one doesn't. Could you just clarify that for me?
Ms. Hagler?
Mr. Chair and Representative Robbins, yes, that's correct. The current law does sunset in 2042. The bill as drafted would keep the sunset for the regular qualified data centers and the refurbished ones, but the large scale new ones that are in this bill would not have a sunset.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, but just to clarify one more time, maybe Ms. Hagler, my understanding is that this would apply to those initial costs when they come online, or is it ongoing refurbishment and reconstruction for the life of the data center?
Ms. Hagler.
Mr. Chair and Representative Robbins, so the software and the equipment, those are ongoing things.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll wrap it up with Chair Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think at this point, probably all of those many people who are here to have this discussion are no longer in the room. I think your testifiers probably flew back to Virginia, so they're not here to answer any of our questions. The corporate lobbyists who came, which is a bummer because hopefully they're tuning in. So, you know, we've talked a lot and we heard from Representative Smith and from our testifiers last week about, you know, some of the concerns with data centers in general coming to our state, to our communities, concerns around water and energy usage, land use, where the appropriate place is for them to go, what the impact is on, you know, people who live near them. And, you know, it's important in this moment. I kind of want to focus more on the industry and this tax incentive rather than those issues, which I think are also really important. And that conversation about the role of data centers in our communities, in our state, outside of sort of tax policy needs to be ongoing. And I think it is in other committees. So in January, I think it was like shortly after President Trump's inauguration, he got up on a stage. He had a guy named Hussein Sajwani with him next to him. He's a billionaire from the United Arab Emirates, and he announced that he's going to invest tens of billions of dollars in data center infrastructure in the United States. I think it was the week afterwards there was an announcement about a project called Stargate, which is a partnership between OpenAI, like Sam Altman, Oracle, Microsoft, and that was an announcement that they were going to invest $500 billion in this technology across the state. There have been a couple references to the Star Tribune's work on this. Walker Orenstein has published a couple articles about this. One of them talked about how Minnesota Utilities project that this industry will grow to 40 times its current size in the next 10 years or so, that the electricity demands of data centers will very shortly equal and eventually exceed power use by all households in Minnesota. So there's a Cushman Wakefield, which is the largest commercial industrial land or property owner and kind of broker in the world, has a data centers working group, and they put out this study last year, and it has kind of an analysis of where the top emerging markets in the world are. And in our region, where Minnesota's in the top five in the world, Minnesota is in the top 10 of emerging markets for data centers. Interestingly, that Cushman Wakefield study, they have different dimensions of sort of like the considerations that go into the decisions that companies make about where to site these facilities. They talk about things like land price, grid reliability, water resources, workforce, and taxes. And they divide these up into three tiers: high impact, medium impact, low impact. Taxes are in the low impact category. If you go through the individual dimensions that they use to determine what the top emerging markets are, Minnesota doesn't appear on the top of any of those lists. What that means, though, is that overall, in the kind of aggregate, Minnesota is a very competitive and appealing place to put these data centers. And that's before this change. That's before we do anything. This is an emerging market, and there's no guarantee, right, like that the Emirati billionaire is going to put those billions of dollars in, that OpenAI and Microsoft are going to keep to their $500 billion pledge. You know, we're in sort of a moment of uncertainty in this market. We know that there's major forces that are pushing these facilities, or like there's momentum, there's a market for them, there's pressure on them. But Minnesota is a very appealing and good place to put these things without changing the law at all. And why is that? Why is that? It's because of a lot of really good things about our state in general. It's because we have abundant clean water that we've taken pains to protect over generations, that we have and our predecessors have, from all kind of ideological angles, have come together to protect our clean water. We have a solid and reliable electrical grid. We have good infrastructure for moving stuff around our state in our roads and our bridges. We have, you know, relatively competitive land prices. We have our 100% clean energy law that we passed, which is appealing to these companies, both from a kind of public relations greenwashing perspective, but also from a cost perspective. And we have talented and well-trained union workforce here who are known for delivering high quality and timely work. We have a lot of good things. Also, one of the hard things about our state is it makes us very appealing, which is our temperature. When the temperature is below 40 or 50 degrees, you can use the ambient air to cool these facilities, which can save 25% to 30% of energy costs. So these are happening. This is the thing, right? We heard in the testimony, these are being built, the jobs are here and they're coming, even if we do nothing. And so we should talk a little bit about this incentive. We've heard it grew. It's grown from $5 million a year, the initial revenue estimate back in 2011, to now it's about 110. We got a new revenue estimate for this change. From revenue, which is, it shows $20 million cost in fiscal year 2028, which is just for the one facility in Rosemount. There are at least 10 of those facilities that are planned of that size or larger, according to this Star Tribune article. It's a little hard because we're not really exactly tracking it. It's happening a lot of different places. But, you know, we're looking at the reason that this shows up on this revenue estimate. When we saw this bill last year, had zero on it. And now it has $20 million. And so we can get a sense of what the scale of the cost of this is going to be moving forward. And the reason that it's on this spreadsheet, though, or that it's on this revenue estimate, is because we're moving. This proposal would move it from a refund-based exemption to an upfront exemption, which changes the timing. These costs are coming for our budget. regardless of whether we do this change or not. This is an uncapped corporate subsidy. This is the equivalent of an open appropriation. This thing, we heard about states where it's grown over the course of a couple years from $150 million to $750 million a year, just due to the accelerated pace of construction of these things. We've talked a lot and our testifiers have talked a lot that the main thing that this does, well, first of all, it removes the sunset, which is in violation of our statute because when we passed our Tax Expenditure Review Commission legislation, I think in 2021, we required an 8-year sunset of all tax expenditures. And so this, in lifting what was already a more than 8-year sunset, I think it violates that part of statute. But what it really does is takes this uncapped corporate tax giveaway, which is already a blank check to multi-billion dollar corporations, especially Google, Meta, Amazon, and their billionaire CEOs, Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos and Mark Zuckerberg. Those three individuals right now own more wealth than the bottom 50% of Americans. It's like a new gilded age. We haven't had this kind of level of wealth and income inequality in our country since before the Great Depression. And so the question is, and so it takes this uncapped corporate tax giveaway that benefits those guys and their companies who they individually have much lower tax liability than any of us do. And those corporations that are getting this benefit pay no income taxes, usually. Maybe they do this year. But you'll see in headlines over the years, oh, Amazon pays no income taxes. And so it moves it from something that we can track precisely to something that we will actually never know the true cost of. And that's the proposal in front of us. It's not even a question of should data centers be in Minnesota? Are they good for our communities? Are they good for our clean energy goals? That's not even the question in front of us. The question in front of us is very narrow. Should we move a sales tax exemption that disproportionately goes to the largest tech corporations in the world from a refund-based exemption where we know exactly down to the dime how much we're spending on it to an upfront exemption which we'll never actually be able to know exactly how much it costs the public? That's why all this pressure is here. And all that pressure is here before this revenue estimate shows the true cost of this thing. And so that's why we had pressure to do it last year, pressure to do it this year, and if we don't get it done this year, there'll be pressure to do it next year. Because corporate power at the Capitol doesn't sleep. So these facilities are here. The hyperscale data centers are here. More are coming. The jobs are here now. We heard it in the testimony. More are coming. We're an appealing place to put these things. But the question for us as practitioners of tax policy is in this moment of major growth in this industry, in a moment of major budget uncertainty, we'll know more tomorrow, but we know that even whatever happens tomorrow, already today we are in a situation of major budget uncertainty, both sort of within the things that we have control of as policymakers, but more kind of more existentially things that are outside of our control at the federal government. And at this moment, do we want to turn what is essentially a blank check to big tech into something where we, instead of them telling us what to write on the line, we just hand them the check, blindfold ourselves, and say, go have fun with our bank account? Is that what we want to do in this moment? Do we want to remove our ability as policymakers to know how much we're actually spending to subsidize the largest, most profitable corporations in the world? And I think the answer is no, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Gomez. I really appreciate that. And all I could think of when you said there's going to be 40, it's going to grow 40 times. There's already 10 planted. We got to get to work here. There you go.
That happens if we do nothing, Mr. Chair, it turns out, strangely.
Maybe, yeah. But just real quick here, and then we'll get on to Mr. Representative Coulter's bill. I just want to read something here. A testament to our commitment to making Minnesota a top state for business innovation investment in our workforce, which this certainly meets that criteria. That's from Governor Walz. Just, I thought that was interesting.
Mr. Chair, I mean, does the department have anything to say about this? I mean, since that's a question from Governor Walz, or a quote from Governor Walz.
I get to ask that question. Would the department like to weigh in?
My apologies, Mr. Chair.
Oh!
Whoa!
All right, here we go.
To the bill, House File 1277. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please. Joanna Bears from the department.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Joanna Bears. I'm the legislative director of the Department of Revenue. The department does not have a position, nor does the governor's office.
I was so excited.
I did want to note, though, there are some concerns when it comes to the tracking piece, and I know people have talked about that previously, but we want to make sure the legislature has the information that they need to, like, measure different expenditures, and having upfront exemptions causes a little bit of an issue with that. And so that's kind of the only comment we wanted to make on that piece.
Okay. Any other comments from the public members?
I just have one question.
Yes, Representative Hewitt.
Chair, thank you, and to the testifier. When other companies, I know there's other companies out there that have these, the airline stuff like that, are those all upfront also, the bigger corporations that we give these exemptions to, or?
Ms. Bears?
Well, what can you generally say?
Mr. Chair, Representative, there are some that have upfront exemption. I believe capital projects or capital investments in our expenditure is an upfront exemption, but most are a refund. So they would pay for it and then get a refund at the end. You know, the upfront exemption, it just becomes a little bit more difficult with auditing because taxpayers, what will happen is the taxpayers will buy the material thinking it's exempt. We come back in the back end to audit them and then they have to pay and do a refund. And so the preferred approach is to do the refund at the end.
Mr. Chair, I'll finish on this one. But my city just built a police station, and they had to do a refund, I believe. Is that common for municipalities, too?
Ms. Bears?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes.
Thank you, Chair.
Last question, Representative Whitty.
Thank you, Chair Davids. Thank you, Ms. Bears. So I just got a quote here when Governor Walz was out in Rosemont at the data center. One of his comments was declare that the construction of the data center as a testament to our commitment to making Minnesota top state for business innovation and investment in our workforce. That seems a little pro data center to me.
Ms. Bears?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we have no position on that bill.
Okay, and with that, I will move that anything else? Yes, Ms. Bears.
Mr. Chair, I did want to add, you know, I know there was comments about the refund process previously with testifiers. We are working with businesses to make sure that refund process is streamlined more so they can get those refunds faster. So we have heard from those groups and are working on something administratively to make sure that happens.
That's great. That's great. Thank you, Ms. Bears. I will move that House File 1277. Had we amended that at all? Laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Mr. Representative Coulter. And then we'll go to Representative Baker here yet?
He's
okay. I want to get Representative Coulter's bill in here. Representative Coulter, welcome to the Tax Committee. If I will move the bill, House File 10, or Chair Gomez will move House File 1088. So members, we're on 1088, the Coulter bill. Are there any amendments, Representative Coulter? Doesn't look like. Okay. Please explain your bill, sir.
Good morning, members. Thank you for the record. I'm Representative Nathan Coulter. I serve District 51B, which is basically the eastern half of the city of Bloomington. And I desperately hope that this bill provokes less discussion than the previous one. House File 1088.
Good luck.
Mr. Chair, I'm pretty sure that was a dig at me, and I duly noted Representative Colton. No.
What I get for
you two can talk later. Okay, Representative Coulter, to the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So House File 1088 is a bill brought forward by the City of Bloomington to extend a property tax exemption for three parcels immediately south of 494, just a little ways east of Highway 77. It was most recently a Ramada Hotel, but those of you familiar with Bloomington or of a certain age may also remember it as the Thunderbird Hotel previous to that. This 11-acre site was initially purchased by the Bloomington Port Authority in 2016, and not long thereafter was envisioned as part of a potential site for a World's Fair Expo. Following disappointing and unsuccessful bids for the World's Fair in 2021 and 2023, and given the changes in market conditions, most notably changes around interest rates, the Port Authority would like some additional time to just simply reevaluate opportunities for economic development in this part of town. And so I will turn things over to Holly Masick. She's the Port Authority Administrator for the City of Bloomington.
Okay, please state your name and who represents for the record, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Holly Masick, and I serve as the administrator of the Bloomington Port Authority, which is the economic development arm of the City of Bloomington. The Bloomington Port Authority purchased the property in question, which was most recently the site of a former Ramada Hotel, in 2016 to prevent low-density uses from being developed on the site and to hold it for a higher and better use. This initiated the 9-year economic development tax exemption on the parcel, which remains publicly owned. The 11-acre site is highly visible and situated just south of MSP Airport and 494. As such, it was identified as an ideal site for the state's World Expo pursuit and held out of development for several years while the government pursued the Expo bid. In 2023, that bid was ultimately unsuccessful. Since then, rising interest rates and slow commercial development have resulted in limited interest from potential buyers. The city is currently reevaluating strategies for the site. The site remains a key development opportunity for Bloomington. It has great potential to attract high-quality investment that will complement the hospitality, high-tech, and residential activity that is occurring in the surrounding South Loop neighborhood. The City of Bloomington and the Port Authority are seeking extended property tax exemption to allow more time to market the site and determine the best option for its future use. We appreciate your consideration of our request, and I am happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. Any questions from members? Basically, just a 5-year extension. I'm kind of concerned about the revenue. It seems pretty pricey to me. 20 grand? No, okay. Any questions for members? I think this is, I don't know if I can say this, I think it's a really good idea because of the factors where you were delayed on doing anything with that property because of, you know, the expo, potential expo. So, questions for members? Okay, with that, I will move House File 1088 be laid over for possible inclusion in an awesome tax bill. Thank you, Representative Coulter, and thank you to your testifier. Item last. Boy, we're moving right along here. Okay, so we'll just, Representative Baker will be here in a little bit, I hope. Okay, members, we are, as I said, we're waiting for Chairman Baker. He has a bill, House File 859, that we would like to discuss here. Tomorrow's agenda, just so we know, House File 1126, Censor Murra Property Tax Exemption for an Indian Tribe. Is that the one like Minneapolis? Or?
That's Minneapolis.
The Minneapolis one? Like, I have one kind of like that, too, I think.
Oh, you do it like a, a tribe owns a property in here?
What's that? Mine's in Minneapolis, I think. Okay. House File 967, Davis Property Tax Exemption established for certain property owned by an Indian tribe. That's, I guess that's the one we're talking about. House File 1066, a Ryer bill. House File 926, a Nash bill. And then we're going to look at House File 1669, a David's bill on income and corporate franchise taxes. So with that, welcome to the committee, Chair Baker. I will move House File 859. And you should have no amendments. Okay, so I'll move House File 859. It'll be for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill after we've had the presentation. So to your bill, Chairman Baker.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you. By the way, the snow has not been shoveled over on this side of the Capitol. So if you leave, you want to make sure you put your boots on. Okay. Oh, my apologies for being late.
No problem.
No disrespect to the members. House File 859, members, is a bill that I have... Sorry.
Let's I literally ran testifier. Up the street.
No. No donuts.
Catch your breath.
Thank you. I don't want to have you guys wait any longer. House File, Mr. Chair, House File 859 is an important bill that I've been working on for quite some time. It's a reasonable exemption for sales tax in manufacturing that exists for everybody else except my industry. It used to be in law years ago. It isn't anymore. And we need to really have serious conversations about bringing this back. 2 years ago, we were having very serious conversations with the Department of Revenue, and that's why this bill, quite honestly, is drafted very detailed out, because the department is expecting something like this to perhaps be in front of them someday. Mr. Chair, members, I'm going to let my testifier, who's not out of breath, talk about the bill, the importance of this, and how this makes complete sense for us to not double tax the folks in the restaurant industry that are collecting taxes on behalf of our Minnesota customers. We need to give our restaurants a chance to be successful. So with that, I'll turn it over. Thank you.
So, Mr. Baker, it's on equipment you buy that makes the food that we eat, and then we're collecting sales tax on it when we eat.
Mr. Chair, it's exactly right. When you make a burger, and you put all the things on a burger, you make it a higher value. So we're collecting money at a higher value on a burger than a restaurant, and we're trying to make sure the equipment that you make it on is not taxed when you're creating a much higher value product.
Because we're getting the tax on the other end. Okay.
Yes, sir.
Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Yes. Thank you. Good morning, Chair Davids, Lead Gomez, and committee members. My name is Hannah Zinn, and I'm the Director of Government Relations for Hospitality Minnesota, which represents the state's restaurant, lodging, resort, and campground sectors, and more. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House File 859, the Food Service Establishment Equipment Exemption. In Minnesota, the hospitality industry makes up over 384,000 jobs, averaging about 12% of the state's total workforce. Our industry is comprised of businesses of varying sizes, business models, and economic impacts. The hospitality industry itself contributes $2.3 billion in annual tax revenue to the state and more than $8.1 billion in total labor income. Minnesota law provides a sales tax exemption for manufacturing equipment used to produce products later resold and taxed at the point of sale. Food service businesses are the only category of manufacturers required to pay the sales tax on their equipment purchases. Including for food service equipment in the capital equipment sales tax exemption will create tax equity, aid the hospitality industry in future economic success, and provide positive benefits like more investment in energy efficient equipment. Given the current market conditions for the hospitality industry, this issue has moved beyond tax equity to contributing to the longevity of an industry that remains in need of support. According to recent quarterly survey findings fielded by Hospitality Minnesota, the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis, and Explore Minnesota Tourism, over 60% of businesses say price inflation for goods and services is the biggest challenge to operation. Wholesale price hikes are still higher than final and retail prices. Hospitality Minnesota and the hospitality industry at large appreciate this legislation's positive move to be fair and equitable related to sales tax exemption. We look forward to serving as a resource for you on our shared goal of good public policy and fostering economic success for hospitality businesses across Minnesota. Thank you.
Any questions for Ms. Zinn? Would any Anyone else like to testify on this bill from the audience here, from the public? Does the department want to testify on this one? Such a disappointment. Okay, no, that's fine. Very good. So any questions for the testifier? Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Baker. Is this tax also applied to used equipment if you're a restaurant owner and buy it from another auctioneer or something like that?
Chair Baker.
Ooh, that might be a question for nonpartisan to be, that's a good question, Representative Hewitt. I believe if you're going to pay tax, sales tax, whether it's new or used, it would apply for anything in the restaurant industry. So unless I'm misstating that, I believe that's the intent of this law. So again, a lot of equipment is purchased used. Stainless steel tables don't really wear out. But I know that I pay tax on them when I buy them from a second retailer. So this would actually probably apply to both, unless I'm corrected by nonpartisan.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hewitt, the bill does not make a distinction between new or used equipment, so the exemption should apply to both.
Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Baker, once again, are you, I don't know if this is the truth, but I've noticed that auctions of this item have went down. Do you feel more restaurant owners, just because of a lot of the recent situations, are slowing down their equipment buys or updating because, you know, are we trying to help them with that, with getting updates and also starting businesses? Is that what this is about more?
Chairman Baker.
Representative Hewitt, if I understand your question, is the restaurant industry slowing down buying new equipment and upgrading? They are, because they don't have the ability to do it as often as they'd like to, or if they want to open up business in Minnesota to begin with. We are hearing, we've all heard around our communities, in the metro especially, some very famous restaurants are closing for different reasons. I think what we're trying to find is, why are we treating our restaurant manufacturing centers that try to provide a very positive a place to go out to eat, a good quality meal? They are collecting a lot of sales tax on behalf of their customers and turning it over to the state of Minnesota. We should give them the same benefit of manufacturing as we do others. And so I think that every little bit we can do to help them will help them stay in business a little longer, maybe grow a little bit more, and then maybe have the ability to spend $100,000 on a couple of new convection ovens or flat tops or deep fryers, and that'll save them about $7,000-$8,000 because they're going to make more hamburgers and they're going to make more food to produce because maybe they're spending more money in their operations. I think we want to encourage them that we don't need to get them taxed on the front end of that purchase because they're going to collect a lot of money for us on the back end when they create a higher valued product.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hewitt. Representative Freiberg.
I say Freiberg. Chair Quam calls me Freitag for some reason.
Freitag. I'm not going there.
Thank you. I heard Chair Baker talk about cheeseburgers, so I'd like to spend a few hours talking about my favorite cheeseburgers.
We'll come back tonight till midnight.
Okay, sounds good. No, actually, I guess I'm just wondering if Chair Baker could explain sort of what sets the, in his mind, what sets the restaurant industry apart from other industries that require the purchase of equipment, and if he sees if opening this door might lead to other industries seeking similar exemptions.
Representative Baker.
That's a Mr. Chair, Representative. That's a very good question. I've thought about that myself too. I own some hotels. I can't find the exemption to qualify there because again, if I buy linens, if I'm buying products that are really ready for use, I'm not looking for exemptions on those kind of things. But when you a restaurant is different because we have the big trucks back up, cases of beef, cases of buns, tomatoes, lettuce. We can go all into the burger if you want to, but I know we don't have time for that. But it's all of that in manufacturing that in this industry, it used to have this exemptions for this same reason as we're allowing Polaris and other big manufacturers. They have those abilities to buy equipment. And the state doesn't charge them because when they sell an Articat or a Skidoo or whatever it is, then we get a lot of tax at that point. Same thing with this is kind of the same concept, but I can't think of another bigger industry like ours that's so impacting on all of us sitting here. We all have our favorite spots at home or here in St. Paul. It affects us, but in the manufacturing world, I know it says it's hard to think about it in that way, but there's little manufacturing operations in the kitchen. They produce something, make it a higher value. We collect full taxes on it, and we should be treated as the same.
Representative Freiberg. We've got two more, then we will. I want to get out about 10, too, so we can get to the floor. Noon, right? Is it noon?
No. Noon.
Okay, Representative Herr. Okay, Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Baker, for being so persistent with this. I remember the discussions we've had before, and some of them made absolute sense, like a place that had a bread-making machine to develop bread and loaves to sell was exempt, but a bread-making machine for dough in a pizza place wasn't. So, like, that made sense to me to level that playing field. But this seems really broad that it could go even down to the knives a chef uses to create the food. So is there a way to make this a little bit more scalable to equipment that, you know, would look more like the equipment that's already exempt in other places?
Chair Baker.
Again, Mr. Chair and Representative, I think that's, again, a very good question. I think what we were trying to drill into here with this kind of thing was much more on the catering side of things. So maybe not so much the day-to-day operations with, again, paper products, things like that. But you're going to see utensils in here, catering equipment, chafer dishes. They are ready to go, but we can't sell anything without having that equipment, whether on display or in the queue ready to go, without having that equipment, whether it's a cooking item in the back or it's display items in the front. Those are the important part of the manufacturing process to be able for all of us to collect the sales tax on that item or that buffet. So it's, and you've heard me say this many times before, I'm open to anything we need to do to work on something that we can work on that we can all afford to see happen. Anything is better than what we have today. So I am a wide open slate to work on what makes sense for everybody for us to find agreement on this.
Chair Joachim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Baker, for being willing to work on it. And I think I would want to look at that route of narrowing it a little bit. We're getting the budget forecast on Thursday, and we have a lot of things in the state, but I'm all for, like, leveling that playing field. That really stuck with me when you presented that last time. So,
thank you, Chair. Vice Chair Joy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Baker. On this bill, you know, like as rural Minnesota, smaller communities shrink, and we have convenience stores that create the hamburgers and all the food and everything like that, and that's kind of their sit-down restaurant sometimes in these smaller communities. Will this exempt them too?
Chair Baker.
I maybe missed the question, Representative Joy. Will it exempt current operations?
The sales tax.
Sure, Joy.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. Like their sales tax on their equipment they purchase, like when they purchase a fryer, purchase stainless steel tables, or they purchase this equipment.
Mr. Chair, this is good as of June of 2025. If you're buying something after that date and this bill passes, that's what it applies towards. Okay. All the equipment that's listed in that specific list would apply to any, would it be a coffee shop, a restaurant, some of the small bistros, yeah, those kind of things, if they're designated as restaurant equipment that's producing that same product, that's exactly right. So my apologies.
Thank you, Chair Baker. Chair Herr?
Thank you, Chair. Representative Baker, Chair Baker, can you tell me, like, under this bill, if, like, food trucks are considered restaurants that would qualify for this exemption as well?
Chair Baker?
You know, in my opinion, if it's producing that same manufacturing model that restaurants are, whether it's in a truck, I don't know if it's if I'm speaking to that right. Do you know that? Yes, you do. Maybe my testifier has a better answer.
Ms. Zinn.
Thank you, Chair Davids and Chair Herr. I would actually defer to nonpartisan staff, but I believe that food trucks are listed under a different definition in 157.15.
Ms. Hagler.
Mr. Chair and Representative Herr, mobile food trucks would be included in this as a food service establishment. That's on line 2.9 of the bill.
Okay, thank you. Chair Herr?
Thank you, and I think that is helpful. Food trucks are small operations, and they should benefit from something like this. But I will just make one quick comment, and I know that Representative Chair Baker, you stated that equipment used to make products that will make something that of a greater value for sale where taxes will be collected. And I would just caution us as a slippery slope that these data centers could say the same thing, that they want tax exemptions for their facilities and their equipment and all the things they do, because they're going to create a product in which we will later, which has a greater value, which will be taxed. And I don't think we want to be giving billions of dollars away and creating and opening that door, because those are the same conversations we're having right now. I think that, you know, to be able to make an economic argument for especially an industry that is struggling, especially after COVID, I think those are really good arguments. But I will say that just the caution of saying if you have a product, if you're using equipment that makes something of greater value later, I think anybody could apply that to anything which opens up a door I don't think we want to open. So I just want to make sure to state that.
Thank you, Chair Hur. Representative Lee.
Thank you, Chair. I also had a question about the scope of the bill. I know Ms. Hagler pointed us to line 2.8, and so curious if that applies then to your mom and pop shop and also maybe like a large fast food corporation would both get the exemption.
Chair Baker.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative. Again, that would include anybody that's in the production of food under the restaurant classification. Also, then they would have to be collecting retail funds and collecting sales tax to be eligible. So it could be a really small mom and pop shop. It could be a large franchise operation in Minnesota. If they're opening up a brand new Dunkin' Donuts or McDonald's, that would apply for them in this case as well. Because again, we think that that's actually good for Minnesota to make sure that we are providing newer operations, updated operations, safer equipment for employees. I think there's a lot of reasons why this makes sense if they're collecting that sales tax at the end in a food operation.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Chair. Yeah, and I just close by saying, you know, I asked that question because I'm also concerned about the administrability of this, right? Like your mom and pop shop might not have a tax accountant who knows, hey, like you can, you know, take credit for this. And so that's just something that I would think about. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Lee. Chair Hur.
I'm sorry, one more question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Lee's question actually made me think about when we think about like food shelves who are having organizations with nonprofit status. I've heard now from a lot of nonprofits that even though they're nonprofits, they're not actually, many of the things they're buying is not tax exempt. And so I'm just curious if this allows for, facilities that are nonprofit that also prepare food, if those will receive tax exemption for the equipment that they're purchasing as well.
Chair Baker.
Again, Mr. Chair, that's a really good question. I think for nonpartisan, we're getting into the area of maybe if they're not collecting retail prices on a product, they may end up having to pay it unless they're already tax exempt. I would defer to nonpartisan on that question.
Ms. Hager.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hur, the exemption is tied to the production of prepared food, which is taxable under 297A. So I'll just have to get back to the committee to make sure that those people you've described would fall into this category.
Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Chair Baker, it would be great once we get the answer to maybe look at ways to include, because there are organizations that are nonprofits, they're not getting tax exemptions for many of the things they're purchasing. And they are like not just food shelves, but like, what did you say, Chair? Soup kitchens and things like that. They're purchasing all of the same equipment and they won't be getting the benefits. So I'd love for you to maybe explore that as well.
Okay, thank you, Chair. Chair Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. While we're exploring that question from Chair Hur, I'd like to throw in that we also look at veterans organizations that prepare food because they have been looking for that for quite a while, and maybe we could also address that issue. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Robbins. Would you like to wrap it up, Chair Gomez?
Just really briefly, Mr. Chair, thank you so much. Thanks, Representative Davids, for bringing this forward. We've heard it a few times. First, as a temporary proposal related to the really kind of catastrophic impacts on this really important industry during the pandemic. And I think because it was temporary and it was really responsive to an emergent situation, there was maybe more of a discussion about it then. But I just, you know, I just want to say that I think the conversation that we've had here today just kind of surfaces some of the issues with this in terms of like what the implications are outside of this sector. of kind of making the argument that any value-added product kind of counts as manufacturing for the purposes of exempting equipment purchases. I do think that, you know, we had sort of a number of questions here that kind of speak to, you know, when we broaden exemptions, when we shrink the tax base, there's sort of, we create precedent, we create greater pressure to do that for other things. And so that's all I wanted to say. I think a previous, like to your point, you know, restaurants are a really punishing industry, very slim margins, and are some of our beloved businesses that enrich all of our communities. And so I appreciate the effort to provide support to them. But, you know, when you do something in the tax area, it's like you do kind of create precedent and potentially create other pressures that then might lead us to make more decisions to erode the tax base further, which is, as we've kind of been talking about, a sort of a theme in our committee of like, how do we maintain the tax base so that we can pay for all the things that people need and the services that we need to provide them. But thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chair Baker, for this proposal.
Thank you, Chair Gomez. With that, I will. You want to wrap it up there, Chair
Mr. Chair and members, thank you for the amazing questions today. I am committed to working alongside of any member that wants to kind of engage, but what I've heard today is my marching orders are to make sure that we get more clarity on a few other things. I'm committed to working with Hospitality Minnesota to get the language right, and we'll provide you with that follow-up in a future date. again, when our restaurants are busy, they're helping us get money in our tax revenue buckets that we really need around here. It's important that we give them all the tools that they need with workforce ideas, with less mandates, with tax advantages that make sense because it's fair. And this is why I hope that this bill has serious consideration at the end of the session. So with that, Mr. Chair, I appreciate your time today.
Thank you, Chair Baker, and to your testifier. I'll renew my motion at House File 859, laid over for possible inclusion in a wonderful omnibus tax bill. Anything else for the good of the order? Good government all the time. We are adjourned.